What do steel, salt, and glass have in common? I'll give you a second to think, because this isn't your average trivia question. Maybe your mind went to construction materials, or even back to high school chemistry, but neither of those guesses is right. The actual answer is that they're all the nicknames of Rust Belt cities that shaped me into who I am today. I grew up in Pittsburgh, the Steel City. Then I moved away for college to Syracuse, the Salt City. And now I live in Toledo, the Glass City. While geographically and culturally distinct, these three cities all have the same heartbeat, a chip on your shoulder identity that, clearly, I can't escape from, and I'm not planning to anytime soon. For the first 7 weeks of our show, you heard the story of Samuel Chang, one of our founders, and how his journey led him first to Toledo, then the East Coast, and then back to Toledo. Now, you'll be hearing from some other members of the Midstory team. We'll be sharing our histories, what brought us to Toledo, and what we found in the Glass City. I'm Evan Blanco, a media fellow at Midstory, and I'll be your host today. From as early as I can remember, my family spent the summers on the river. Every Friday, we would drive to the marina where my uncle kept his boat and spend the whole day on the water. One of my favorite parts of boating as a kid was when a huge barge would pass, hauling coal down the river. My siblings and I would quickly jump up and start flagging the captain to honk the horn. I never really thought about it much as a kid, but seeing the remnants of industry is an unavoidable part of boating in Pittsburgh. For every barge and train that passed, we passed just as many empty factories, closed power plants, and abandoned infrastructure. My hometown has hundreds of more idiosyncrasies like this, but I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't really appreciate them until I left. In 2022, I went to Syracuse University to pursue a degree in video editing. I was suddenly surrounded by peers from all over the world and from cities much bigger than Pittsburgh. I remember one of my first nights. I was eating dinner with friends and we landed on the inevitable conversation of regional accents. Unfortunately, Pittsburgh has a very distinct dialect.
Hey, Mary Lou's on the way down, okay? I wouldn't lie to you.
I didn't grow up talking like that, so I always thought it was just something to laugh at. But that night at dinner, it became a badge of honor. Throughout my first semester, I kept having similar moments, where something that I took for granted as a kid suddenly became an identity that I cling to, and I became very homesick. Luckily, I discovered something else during my first semester, a love for documentary filmmaking. I had something to prove, and I finally had the toolkit to make it happen. For the rest of my time at college, I pursued those idiosyncrasies, those seemingly small but important stories that too often go unnoticed. In my senior year, all of my peers were headed off to New York City or LA to pursue their big city dreams. It was pretty intimidating because the big city had never been my end goal, and I was struggling to find resources to pursue my more modest future. Luckily, I found Midstory. When I first read about them during a virtual career fair, I swear they secretly knew exactly what I was looking for. Thankfully, they felt the same way about me. So now I'm in my third Rust Belt city, taking everything I've learned from Pittsburgh and Syracuse to continue to tell the type of stories that need to be told here in the Midwest. Welcome to the Midstory Hour, a show produced by Midstory in collaboration with WGTE. This week, we're featuring stories about having something to prove. Here at Midstory, we believe in the power of storytelling, especially about the places we call home. We've covered thousands of stories from across all 12 Midwest states, and each week on the Midstory Hour, we will share a few with you. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to learn something new about the place you call home, and likewise, learn something new about places you've never been. This week, listen to the second episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy, a podcast produced by Reckoning Inc. in collaboration with Ohio Humanities. The Copperhead Conspiracy tells a little-known story from the Civil War about a treasonous Midwestern plot to bring down the Union. Next up is the story of Fremont, Ohio, who supplies half the country with Heinz ketchup. Finally, you'll hear about the recent Lost Region Conference in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where historians and researchers alike met to preserve the story of the Midwest. If you enjoy this program, be sure to listen to other episodes and check us out at midstory.org or on our socials. Abraham Lincoln is revered as one of the greatest presidents in our country's history. He regularly tops lists along with George Washington and FDR. With such respect given to Honest Abe in the modern day, it's almost impossible to imagine the outrage that resulted from his election. In the second installment of The Copperhead Conspiracy, we explore how the election of 1860 accelerated the national divorce and, in the Midwest, created the Copperhead Movement. Here is Birth of a Movement, the second episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy, an Ohio Humanities and Reckoning Inc. podcast.
Dear sir, we write you at the urgent request of several of our Republican citizens. Ours is perhaps the most intensely pro-slavery county in the state. Many of the most active and influential Democrats are heartily in sympathy with the rebel states. They are maddened by the present attitude and activity of the federal government and would gladly seek their vengeance on such Republicans as are within their reach.
The letters started to arrive in the office of Illinois Governor Richard Yates shortly after the attack on Fort Sumter, which began the Civil War in April 1861.
We believe that our lives and property are in danger. We are mostly without arms. None of us are properly prepared for defense in such an emergency. We want rifles and revolvers. Is it within the policy of the state to supply exposed communities with the means of defense? If so, can we have any help? Truly yours for American liberty, Parker Earle.
These letters were saying, there are Democrats marching in the woods down here. Please send troops.
Jennifer Weber is a professor of history at the United States Air Force Academy and author of the book, The Copperheads.
Very alarmed and alarming letters from the very, very beginning of the war about these people out there who disagreed with the war and were picking up arms in response to that against the federal government.
These letters from Republican citizens of Illinois, deathly afraid of their neighbors, speak volumes about the emerging threat of anti-government activity from Democrats in the Midwest who were against the war, and how that could play into the hands of the Confederacy. These Democrats, known as Copperheads, became a monumental challenge for the new administration of President Abraham Lincoln, and one that would only get worse as the war progressed. This is the Copperhead Conspiracy. I'm Dan Gediman. In many respects, it's a minor miracle that the United States didn't devolve into a full civil war years before 1861. For decades, really since the first Constitutional Convention in 1787, America had been embroiled in arguments large and small pertaining to the institution of slavery. Especially as the country expanded westward, the issue of where slavery would be legal and where it would not consumed much of Congress's time and energy. Throughout the early 19th century, various efforts were attempted to thread the needle between the South's desire for more land to grow cotton and the North's increasing discomfort with slavery. There was the Missouri Compromise of 1820, the Compromise of 1850, and the Kansas-Nebraska Act. But rather than solve the underlying problem, each just seemed to kick the can down the road, buying some time until the next crisis occurred. Into the fray of this increasingly combustible national discussion about slavery came the brand new Republican Party, and specifically a former Illinois congressman named Abraham Lincoln. His party, while firmly against the expansion of slavery into new territories, made room for a variety of viewpoints on the subject. This posed a significant challenge for Lincoln as an emerging leader within his party. He was allied with the party's moderate wing, which accepted the continuation of slavery in the states where it already existed. But he was also mindful of the views of the more radical members of the party, who advocated for the complete abolition of slavery throughout the country. It was a difficult tightrope to walk. Historian Chris Phillips.
And he is very consistent in his speeches about opposing slavery, saying, "I've always hated slavery. I can't remember a time when I didn't hate it," things of that sort. And then, of course, later, his most famous speeches, the House Divided speech, for example. Many Southerners hear that, and they hear someone who seems radical to them, Democrats in particular. They feel that he is far too extreme. They feel that if he were ever to be elected to a national office, that he would follow through on some of his objections to slavery. And that becomes a real sticking point for an awful lot of people in their support, not only for the Republican Party, but also in their support for Lincoln himself.
And indeed, in 1860, Abraham Lincoln was chosen as the Republican candidate in an unprecedented four-way race for president, along with nominees from the Northern Democratic Party, the Southern Democratic Party, and the Constitutional Union Party. It was a very tight election. And when the dust settled, Lincoln won the Electoral College and thus the presidency, even though he only won just shy of 40% of the popular vote.
For some Americans, they felt that it was rigged. They felt that it wasn't legitimate. And they didn't really accept Lincoln as their president. They also were deeply sensitive about the fact that now the Republican Party has the presidency, and it also has the House of Representatives, that they would now begin to throw their weight around, and that they felt that naturally, given the anti-slavery proclivities and the platform of the Republican Party, they felt that they would begin the process of ending slavery in the nation.
Almost as soon as it became clear that Republican Abraham Lincoln had won the 1860 election, a violent backlash erupted from Democrats, and not just in the southern states that were seceding.
The people who lost the election of 1860 didn't want to deal with the results and sought to thwart the impact of having lost that election.
Mark Lowes is an emeritus professor of history at the University of Cincinnati.
In January, after the election, there were assaults on federal buildings and federal installations all over. This was aimed, of course, at thwarting the impact of losing the election of 1860. And you have attack after attack on U.S. arsenals, on hospitals, on paymaster stations, on forts. Now, when we talk about what was taking place in many communities across the North, were attacks on U.S. recruiters, were attacks on encampments of volunteers. There were a lot of things that were taking place across the North that looked as though, they were organized, coherent, violent actions against federal authorities.
In addition to Democrats resorting to overt violence to oppose the federal government, they also used political means to undermine the war effort, in particular in the Midwest, where they controlled state legislatures. This was especially true after the 1862 midterm elections, held shortly after Lincoln's announcement of the Emancipation Proclamation, which would take effect on January 1st, 1863.
The 1862 election was like a tidal wave.
Historian Chris Phillips.
It energized the opposition. The governors then were hard-pressed to get anything through. And in fact, the Democrats were even more energized to try and obstruct, openly obstruct, anything that these governors tried to do.
The Republican Midwestern governors used a parliamentary procedure known as proroguing to nullify the power of their majority Democratic legislatures by refusing to call the legislature into session. But it was a questionable victory, as it served to radicalize many rank-and-file Democrats in those states.
Proroguing the legislatures of these states in many ways fueled the opposition in ways that they had not been energized prior to it. It almost seemed to me, at least, that the Democrats had some kind of grim satisfaction in knowing that they were in the majority and that they had the ability to continue to make the war effort difficult. And so by proroguing the legislatures, the only thing left to the Democrats to do was violent obstruction. At the local level, we see that playing out with absolute violence in the streets of small towns throughout this region, where Democrats who are disenfranchised have nothing left to lose except to fight it out. And that kind of triggers a civil war within the civil war in many of these small towns and cities throughout the Midwest.
Many Democrats were also enraged by a series of actions taken by the Lincoln administration. The first of these was Lincoln's decision to suspend the writ of habeas corpus and impose martial law, something he said he was compelled to do to stop violent anti-war activities in Maryland and several other northern states. The second major action that Lincoln took, which angered many Democrats, was the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed enslaved people in southern states newly occupied by the Union Army. But it also contained another provision that turned many Democrats against the war, especially in the border states where slavery was still legal.
The more important piece of the Emancipation Proclamation is that it authorizes the federal government to recruit African Americans to join the Union Army.
Eric Jackson is a professor of history and Black studies at Northern Kentucky University.
And so that becomes literally a fear factor, because now you're going to be afraid of what these enslaved African Americans who now have guns could do. The imagery was so palpable to people in the country, it scared them because they didn't know. Which brings up so many mythologies. Meaning, because the justification of enslaved people was not just from a Christian standpoint, the argument was this whole weird kind of, they couldn't be educated, they should just be followers and not leaders. Well, all of a sudden, when they have guns, people fear them.
Since the 1790s, the United States had a law on the books forbidding Black people from serving in the United States Army.
Again, historian Jennifer Weber.
That's because Americans, particularly in the South, were terrified by the prospect of Black men legally carrying arms and knowing how to use them. There was no more terrifying sight, particularly to a Southern American, but also to some people in the North, than looking down the road and seeing Black troops bearing rifles walking down the road toward you, wearing a Union uniform.
The Emancipation Proclamation, of course, we always focus on the impacts that it has on the South. We don't often focus on the dissension and disruption that it creates in the North.
Patrick Lewis is the director of the Filson Historical Society in Louisville and author of For Slavery and Union.
There are still a large number of Democrats who did not vote for Abraham Lincoln who are deeply ambivalent about this war in the first place. And now that the war aims seem to have changed fundamentally, really start to oppose and think about how can I, you know, stay out of this war personally, but also maybe actively work to bring it to a close in some sort of resolution that creates a separate independence for the South, right? If they want to go and continue to enslave people, that's fine. Let them do that. I'm tired of paying for this thing.
The next major event that galvanized the Copperheads was the Enrollment Act, which took effect in March of 1863 and created a process for registering able-bodied men to be drafted into the Union Army. Resistance to the draft started almost immediately throughout the northern states, and this resistance took many forms.
It was one thing when they didn't want to fight in a war for Union. Now it's an entirely different matter to be compelled to fight, forced to fight in a war for abolition. And that becomes an absolute non-starter. So there are lots of really creative ways that folks are sort of getting around these drafts. Of course, the most sort of well-known one is hiring substitutes. There are draft insurance pools. So you can buy in with a pool of other men. And if your name gets selected, the insurance pool will pay your substitute fee for you.
While some in the Union states evaded the draft by paying fees or hiring substitutes, others resorted to violence against those who were charged with implementing the draft. Sometimes this took the form of full-scale riots, most infamously in New York City. Again, Jennifer Weber.
We still don't really know how many people were killed in that, but I believe that estimates exceed 1,000 people there, and many of those people would be African Americans. New York is only the most extreme example. There was a very large riot in Boston, a riot in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. There's a county in west central Pennsylvania, Clearfield County, that is so angry and so violent and so combustible that draft agents won't even go into the county because they fear for their own lives. And that's just to write down the names of the people who live in the county. That's not going through an entire draft process. But it becomes very dangerous for the agents of the United States government to do their job because their lives are being threatened. Their crops are being burned, their houses are being burned or attacked, their families are being threatened. It is a really, really frightening time.
If there was one event during 1863 that particularly riled up Copperheads in the North, it was one that involved Ohio Congressman Clement Vallandigham. The importance of Vallandigham in the Copperhead movement and the eventual conspiracy with the Confederates cannot be overstated. He appears in the official records of both the Union and the Confederacy and is mentioned by virtually everyone who has left behind memoirs of this period. And by the middle of 1863, it seemed that every speech he gave just poured gasoline on an already smoldering fire of Democratic discontent. But in one particular speech he made, he appeared, at least to one military leader, to step over the line into something approaching treason.
But I warn also the men in power that there is a vast multitude, a host whom they cannot number, bound together by the strongest and holiest ties to defend, by whatever means the exigencies of the time shall demand, their natural and constitutional rights as free men, at all hazards and to the last extremity.
The general who was in charge of the Department of the Ohio, a man named Ambrose Burnside, had issued an order to the general public saying that anybody who spoke out against the administration or the war effort was subject to be tried by a military tribunal and imprisoned. And that is exactly what happened to the Landingham. The problem was that Burnside had not told anybody he was going to do this. Lincoln had no idea, and he was really in a pickle here. Even Republicans recognized that this was a pretty drastic violation of the Landingham's free speech rights. And so in Washington, all these Republicans are wringing their hands about, what do we do about this that doesn't completely undermine our general, but also doesn't land this man in prison? And, you know, trust Lincoln to come up with a solution that is both kind of funny and extremely practical. Lincoln's attitude was, okay, you seem to like the Confederates an awful lot. Why don't we send you down there to live with them? And you can just be among your people.
Well, there's a lot of folks in the Midwest who are outraged by that, who saw Vallandigham as exercising not only his rights as a citizen, but his duties as a congressman.
Robert Churchill is a professor of history at the University of Hartford and author of To Shake Their Guns in the Tyrant's Face.
And so that sort of coalesces all of this anger. And you start getting these rural mutual protection societies coming out into the open, holding military parades, giving three cheers for Vallandigham as they do it. And it looks like all of this is going to come into a head in June of 1863, when all of the enrollment officers have to go out into the countryside and put everybody's names on a list so that they then will be part of the grand draft lottery that is to come. And when those enrollment officers in this environment go out into the countryside to complete that enrollment, violence does break out. Some of it is violent intimidation, but there are also assassinations. There's five enrollment officers who are assassinated in Indiana and Illinois within the space of about 2 weeks.
In the wake of Vallandigham's arrest and exile from the United States, Copperheads began to contemplate progressively more radical actions against the federal government, including conspiring with the Confederacy. And to a large degree, they were overtly fighting to maintain a status quo that protected the role of white people in America. Again, Patrick Lewis.
In the midst of the Civil War, small farmers, middle-class people in towns and cities and rural counties throughout what we now call the Midwest and the Upper South recognized that the war that they had signed up to fight in 1861, a war for the preservation of the Union, was increasingly becoming a war for the emancipation of slaves. And they believed that this violated the very foundations of American democracy, which they believed rested on whiteness. It rested on white possession of the land that they lived on in these states north of the Ohio River, which their grandfathers, maybe even fathers, had fought and won from native peoples. And that was very much the way that they dreamt of the United States, as a place that could be a white man's republic. And as the Lincoln administration gradually shifted more and more towards the outright abolition of slavery, lots of people throughout the country, but especially in these states of the old Northwest, recognized that this was not the republic that they believed they were defending 2 years before. And so as the election of 1864 dawned, they recognized that they had this opportunity to get this tyrant usurper out of office. And while we recognize that they were working with, you know, active Confederate agents who were trying to overthrow the United States, a lot of the people who got swept up in this conspiracy would have told you that, unlike the Confederacy, what they were doing was the most patriotic act. They would have claimed that what they were doing was not treason,
but in fact was the highest act of pure patriotism that they could to cut out this cancer that they believed the Republican Party was becoming on the United States.
As the violence against Republicans escalated, and evidence piled up that the Copperheads might be working directly with Confederate agents, Midwestern governors reached out to military leaders to come up with a solution. Together, they decided they needed to fight back by using any means at their disposal, including the recruitment of spies.
He is a classic spy. This is James Bond stuff happening in the 1860s in cities across the Midwest.
That's next time on The Copperhead Conspiracy. The Copperhead Conspiracy is a production of Reckoning, Inc. with funding and scholarly assistance from Ohio Humanities. It was produced and narrated by me, Dan Gediman. Our historical consultant was Dr. Stephen Rockenbach. Voice actors were Alec Voles and Barrett Cooper. Our theme music was composed by Jacori Arthur, with other music licensed from Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Nina Ellis, Louisville Public Media, and to Loretta Williams for editorial guidance. Major support for this series was provided by Archon Construction. Additional support from Jay and Susan Giles, Doreen Yuhas Sauer, Lopa Mehrotra, and Douglas and Marissa Brown. Many thanks to Jennifer Weber, Mark Lowes, Christopher Phillips, Eric Jackson, Patrick Lewis, and Robert Churchill, whose interviews were heard in this episode. Please note that the views expressed by Jennifer Weber do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force Academy, the U.S. Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. If you would like to support our nonprofit organization and unlock bonus episodes of this series, you can do so at patreon.com/reckoningradio. Our first bonus episode explains all the key events in American history that led to the Civil War. You can access that and more at patreon.com/reckoningradio. For transcripts, a bibliography, and other content related to this series, please visit our website at copperheadconspiracy.org. That's copperheadconspiracy.org. And if you haven't already done so, please leave a review of this series on whatever platform you use to hear it. It will really help other listeners to find this podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Please join us next time for another episode of The Copperhead Conspiracy.
If you're just joining us now, you're currently listening to the Mid-Story Hour. Tune in every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. to hear hidden stories from Toledo, the Midwest, and beyond. You can also find this podcast on midstory.org or wgte.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is the official home of Heinz, which was founded there in 1869. But today, the vast majority of Heinz ketchup is manufactured in Fremont, Ohio, just 35 miles southwest of Toledo. Fremont produces more than 1 billion pounds of ketchup every year, along with the iconic plastic bottles. Locals swear the air even smells of it. Hungry yet? Last summer, intern Desiree Lua learned all about the ketchup capital of the United States. She chats with reporter Celia Johnson about the history of Heinz, what foods pair best with ketchup, and how you can tell if the bottle in your fridge was made in Fremont.
Good to see you, Celia. My name is Desiree Lua, and I was an intern at Midstory in the summer of 2025. And during my time there, I wrote several stories, one of which was about Heinz ketchup and its factory in Fremont, which makes most of the Heinz ketchup you find around the world.
Well, great. Thanks for joining us today, Desiree. So, I mean, let's start off with the all-important question, which is, are you a fan of ketchup?
I am definitely a fan of ketchup. I think it's hard to find people who aren't. I've been, unfortunately, you know, eating a lot of like burgers and fries now that I'm back at college. And I feel like even if you don't start out as a fan, I feel like you eventually become a fan of ketchup.
Is that what drove you to write this story about ketchup, or was there a deeper reason?
I wrote the story because I think you actually mentioned it during the research workshop you did for interns. And you said that this would be a great story for us to write because it's locally oriented. It's kind of interesting. Like, no one knew that there was this big Heinz ketchup factory in Fremont. So that just drove me to do more research. And I found out it was really interesting. So really all the credit to the pitch goes to you.
I actually didn't know that. I'm very flattered. Yes, I think I had a picture of the Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Library in my slideshow because that's the other thing that Fremont is known for. And maybe mm-hmm. I mentioned the ketchup factory as well. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you know, paint a picture of this factory in Fremont for us.
Well, I wasn't personally able to visit the factory, but I talked to some people who have or, you know, have grown up near ketchup factories. Honestly, I think it kind of just looks like a standard factory from the outside. You really wouldn't know watching from the outside that this factory produces 1 billion pounds of ketchup every year, but that's what happens inside. And according to the people I talk to, it's a lot of machinery on the inside, you know, your standard factory fare. But it's really like a conveyor belt style is what they said. And I think that's standard for such a mass produced process. Mm-hmm. I think also one of the distinguishing features of being near the factory is that you can always smell ketchup in the air, which I think is a lot more interesting than how the factory looks or what goes on on the inside. I think that was the detail that I heard that made me go, oh, that's very interesting. I didn't know that before.
Yeah, I can't imagine with most factories you want to be smelling the product they make.
Yeah, so. I think in this case, it's good because, you know, I don't know how popular the smell of ketchup is, but I think there are a lot worse smells that you can be around.
I think it would make me hungry.
For sure.
I think one of your interviewees had a story about that too, right?
Yeah, I talked to a man who grew up not near the Fremont factory, but near the old Heinz ketchup factory in Bowling Green. And he said that whenever he smelled ketchup, he'd want to go to the nearby McDonald's for fries and burgers with his siblings, which I thought was super sweet. And like you mentioned, I think being around that smell would definitely make anyone hungry.
So maybe it's actually a very successful secret marketing campaign from Big Fry. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, this wasn't always the only plant in Ohio. There used to be a plant in Bowling Green. So let's rewind time a little bit and talk about the history of the Heinz Company. So, I mean, how long has this company been around?
So despite Heinz having its largest modern day factory in Fremont, it actually did not sadly begin in the Midwest. It was founded in Pittsburgh in 1869 by Henry John Heinz. And the story goes that he started by growing crops, that sort of thing in his own backyard when he was little and selling them to neighbors. I think it was some variation of sauerkraut. So, you know, from the start, he was kind of a businessman in that sense. So Heinz grew in Pittsburgh, but with industrialization and there being less room to grow the crops required, the company eventually expanded to the Midwest, also with the help of railroads and advanced transportation systems. So it had factories in St. Louis, Chicago, and then the Bowling Green factory was its first Ohio location, and that opened in 1914. And ever since, I think the company's had a pretty large presence in the Midwest, also have expanded to California for pretty obvious reasons.
Well, Pittsburgh is a Rust Belt city, so maybe we can have, you know, not full Midwest, but pretty close.
Pretty close, yeah.
So you mentioned that Heinz started out selling vegetables. So how did he get from vegetables to ketchup? And, you know, like we said earlier, ketchup is everywhere now. So was it always that popular? I imagine it must be their most popular product now. Was that always true?
Yeah, well, I think for the time that Heinz was in charge of the company, at least the Henry John Heinz that we're talking about, because the Heinz family ran the corporation. But during his era, ketchup was definitely not the most popular product. Mm. It was more soup and pickles. I know that sounds strange, but that was a lot spurred by the Great Depression, which was also kind of after Heinz's time, but, you know, kind of when the company started to pick up steam. And it was actually diner culture that spurred the popularity of ketchup in the 1950s, because that played into a lot of different marketing campaigns. I know there are a lot of famous diner-oriented ads from that time period. And one of the curators at the Heinz Museum, who I spoke to, said that, you know, the diner tradition of hamburgers and fries really just set ketchup up as this great condiment, because I think she mentioned what goes better with hamburger and fries, what's kind of more American than hamburger and fries with ketchup.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And sounds like you yourself have come back to finding that those are a perfect pairing.
For
and
sure.
It makes sense. A condiment is only as strong as the thing you're dipping in it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, is it just the liquid, or I don't know if I should say liquid, because like you said earlier, they measure ketchup in pounds, which might suggest that it's a solid. But is it just the ketchup itself that's made in Fremont?
Interestingly, no. So the usual standard bottle of Heinz ketchup that you see at the restaurant table or on the grocery store shelves, the whole entire package is created in Fremont, which I found super interesting.
Yeah.
So there are some local packaging companies who create the molds for that iconic Heinz bottle shape. And then there are also packaging companies that create the bottle itself. So really the whole process is just handmade in Fremont. And I think that's just so cool that, you know, this global product has its roots in this town in Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty rare to have a full service operation in one place.
For sure.
Well, you know, if you look at a quarter, it has a P or a D, and that tells you whether or not it was minted in Philadelphia or Denver. So is there anything like that for ketchup? Is there a way for listeners to tell if their ketchup came from nearby?
Yeah, there absolutely is. One of the packaging companies I spoke to said that if you grab a Heinz ketchup bottle, so the next time you're at a restaurant, you can try this out, and you see FR printed at the bottom, that means that the bottle itself was manufactured in Fremont, most likely in one of the factories 10 minutes drive away from the Heinz factory itself. And then if you look at the lid and you see the same engraving FR, that means the ketchup was produced in Fremont. So some people, wherever they go in the world, they'll be able to find ketchup and bottles made in Fremont.
That's pretty special. I'll definitely be on the lookout the next time I'm putting ketchup on my fries. Well, you know, ketchup definitely seems to have found a home in Fremont, Ohio, but there are many who say that Heinz should still belong to Pittsburgh. One of them is one of our very own fellows, Evan, who hails from Pittsburgh. So, you know, what do you say to Evan's contention that actually, you know, the Heinz legacy belongs to Pittsburgh?
Well, I mean, I can't lie. Pittsburgh has a huge hand in creating the Heinz legacy. It was where the company started. The Heinz Museum is still there today. So, you know, really can't discredit Pittsburgh for just shaping the Heinz brand itself. But I think when it comes to the product itself, you have to acknowledge the role that cities like Fremont play in the production process. You know, I think we all commonly associate Heinz with Pittsburgh, so it can be easy to forget that, you know, sometimes these products are actually made in smaller towns that we don't consider as much. But, you know, they're just as important. Like I mentioned, this ketchup accounts for... this ketchup goes all around the world. I think it accounts for around 80% of the ketchup that you see out there. So really, I think Heinz wouldn't be possible both without Pittsburgh and without Fremont. I think you have to have all those cities as well as the other places where ketchup is produced.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about ketchup, Fremont, and Heinz. Is there anything else we didn't discuss that you think listeners should know about the story?
No, just next time you see a bottle of Heinz ketchup out in the wild, see if you can find an FR engraved somewhere.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Celia.
Mark your calendars for Saturday, April 11th for the largest regional pickleball tournament held at the University of Toledo, the Toledo Pickleball Classic and Career Futures Expo. The event is free and open to the public and will feature tournaments across corporate teams, Utilito student orgs, and local high schoolers, a career futures expo with 80 plus companies looking for the next round of talent, and a community carnival with bouncy houses, a free kids pickleball clinic, food trucks, and more. Visit ToledoPickleballClassic.org for more info.
In November 2025, the Lost Region Recovery Project invited scholars and artists from across the country to a conference in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Their goal? The revival of the Midwestern studies. Regional study is not a new idea, yet the incorporation of interdisciplinary study unique to the Midwest has been largely overlooked in academics, hence the title of Lost Region. But how do you rediscover a lost region? Who do you need to do it? The conference aimed to answer these questions through a day of presentations spanning history, art, sports, politics, and more. Reporting on this conference is Community Fellow Caitlin Cooper. She chats with fellow Yaffa Siegel about her experience at the event, as well as her time in Sioux Falls.
Today we're talking about the Sioux Falls Midwestern Studies Conference that you attended. Yeah. So I guess just to get into it a little bit, what is Midwestern Studies? Because personally, I've never heard of, like, well, what is it?
So Midwestern Studies is essentially an interdisciplinary regional studies movement. Mm-hmm. So in academia, there are these kind of subfields of regional studies. So it could be looking at the South and its history and its culture, or it could be looking at either of the coasts. But in the case of the Midwest, it's kind of been forgotten. Mm-hmm. There are not these centers for regional study of the Midwest, or there's not the funding that exists for the other regions. So this is kind of what the lost region is. Mm-hmm. And Midwestern Studies is kind of the culmination of this decade-long project that's been spearheaded by this professor called John Lauck. And he's been doing a lot of work in authoring books and setting up associations and journals, all based on studying the Midwest.
Awesome. Well, it's really cool. So Midwestern Studies is its own subfield in American studies.
It's interdisciplinary. Okay. So it came out of history studies originally, mm-hmm. because John Lauck was interested in history. Mm-hmm. And these regional studies subfields are usually focused on history. But what he realized was, if you're trying to spearhead a movement in academia, but kind of in anything, it kind of you need as many all hands on deck as you possibly can. So he's kind of branched it out into other humanities. So we've got like English, or we've got like politics, law, but then also musicology, also sports. Basically, any kind of way in to talk about the Midwest in academia, that's all on board with Midwestern Studies. And that's why it's called Midwestern Studies, not Midwestern History Studies.
Oh, yeah. Because I guess you're taking pretty much every aspect of like the economics, culture, history of the Midwest and bringing it all into one place.
Exactly. Like everyone has the same cause. Why not do it all under the same umbrella together?
So this conference then, you're bringing all of these like experts in different fields to one place. What was that like? What did you guys talk about?
Exactly. So the conference was, it was a one-day conference.
Okay.
It was hosted in the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls, which is kind of a bit of a historical landmark there, because it was the only high school that existed for the first like 100 years of Sioux Falls history. Now it's a theater. So they hosted the conference in one of the auditoriums there. The conference had maybe around 25 presentations, I think. And like I said, they were from all different subjects. Mm-hmm. People were talking about sports. People were talking about the Midwest, how it influenced sci-fi even. Just a ton of things that you would never think that the Midwest had a part to play in, or things that have not really been studied about and their effects in the Midwest. But it was amazing because it brought together people who had the same passion and the same cause for recovering this lost region.
Well, that's very cool. You said there were a lot of different presentations. Were there any particular presentations that spoke to you? Anything that we might want to hear about?
Well, so the conference started really early, right? It started at 8 a.m.
Great.
Which is early for some of us.
Yes.
And the first panel, bright and early, 8 a.m., present perils, the decline of the history profession in the Midwest. And what that presentation was by Jeff Bremer, who's a history professor at Iowa State University. Mm-hmm. And he basically gave you the lowdown of how the history profession is really suffering in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. I think he said that undergraduate enrollment in history classes has fallen by half, which is quite dramatic. And this is having a knock-on effect in not only history departments, but also then the jobs the history professors can or can't get. And then also just humanities more broadly. It's kind of an epidemic that's happening with the humanities right now. And that was kind of a shock to hear that at 8 a.m. Like,
yeah,
here's the dire state of this field.
I guess at 8 in the morning, just hitting it straight with, yeah, everything's dying. It's all going away. Kind of a bummer, but maybe that's sort of like the cold water in the face that you need to get started for the rest of the...
Exactly. And also it's the truth of it.
Yeah.
But the hopeful thing is that's how it started. That's not how it ended. Throughout the day, we had tons of more hopeful presentations. A lot of hope is seen in just the people who are there. Like I said, they all have this passion for reviving study of the Midwest. But there are a lot of hopeful ways that that is happening. So there were some presentations on ethnic studies and these kind of forgotten voices that are really important to Midwestern history. There are also people who are trying to think of interdisciplinary pathways to kind of revive this study as well, including like literature and how do we create a Midwestern canon, which I thought was a really interesting panel as well.
What would a Midwestern canon look like?
It included some books like... Little House on the Prairie, I think, was like something that came up. But I think her main point was about like a return to nature, that like nature and the rural is really important in the Midwest and how we can really engage with that through, I think she was talking a lot about like children's fiction and children's picture books and how we can get that love for rural nature back through books.
That's awesome. Because I know there's this sort of idea that like the Midwest is sort of like a bellwether for like the rest of the country. And I wonder like, with like the decrease in people studying history, like undergraduate enrollment, is that not happening? That's happening everywhere, isn't it?
It is happening everywhere. It's nationwide.
Yeah.
But the Midwest, I think, is being hit slightly harder because of a lot of the costs involved with going to university. A lot of students who are enrolling, they want to see a more lucrative return on their college degree. Yeah. So they're turning to things like engineering. They're turning to things like economics or... things that they think they can get better careers out of. And in this day and age, with the costs of student loans, like, it's smart, it's sensible. And they might not have, students in the Midwest might not have that, like, degree reputation that someone in the Ivies can say, yeah, I have a history degree. Maybe people are not looking for history degrees, but it's from Princeton, so I'm going to get hired anyway. I think there's that kind of thinking.
Yeah. Why Sioux Falls specifically? This is South Dakota.
Yes. So the Middle West Review is the journal that hosted the conference, and they are based in South Dakota. And John Locke even said that part of it was that they wanted to show off Sioux Falls. According to John Locke, Sioux Falls is like not really in the limelight, but he said it's one of those really booming Midwestern cities that kind of deserves its flowers a little bit. I had never been to Sioux Falls before, never been. That was the furthest west I had ever been. And I actually loved it. I was only there for the weekend. No offense to Sioux Falls. I kind of expected it to be kind of nothing. You don't really hear anything about it. I'm from England. There's so many cities and towns in America that I haven't heard of. So it's hard for me to have any expectations. But I was really blown away. Their downtown was so walkable. It was so vibrant. There were these amazing restaurants with chefs who were from TV shows and won awards. And then just like, a stone's throw away, if you pardon the pun, are the falls themselves.
Ah.
And they're like beautiful. So
it was. So there are falls there. I'm from the US. I've never been to Sioux Falls, but
there are falls. They're like rocky falls. Oh, and they're right near the downtown.
That's really cool.
I sat there for like 2 hours, I think, just with headphones on, listening to music, take them off, listen to the waterfall.
You are from England. And
yes.
So Midwestern studies, I feel like that's something that's sort of flying under the radar within the United States. So why as someone international?
Yes. Yeah. So that was actually something that was quite remarkable about the conference was that you would expect that the people who are trying to revive the study of the Midwest would be Midwesterners themselves. They have, I guess, so. More stake in the game.
Right.
But actually, a lot of the presenters were from all over the nation. Mm. So MidStory's own mission is kind of really in alignment with this project. We want to uncover these forgotten Midwestern stories and importance. And so any project that is in line with that, we're all on board. We want to know all about it. So that was why I went out there to kind of check out, scope out the scene, kind of get those connections going. But also, I'm also undertaking a PhD in American Culture Studies at Bowling Green State University, where my research is going to focus on kind of Rust Belt studies, which is tangentially Midwest. They are very interconnected. And that's another way into this Midwestern Studies project is uncovering these Rust Belt stories. So,
yeah. What drew you to Rust Belt studies specifically?
Mainly through the MidStory work, because coming over from England, I hadn't really heard of any of this boom and bust history of deindustrialization. It was all totally new to me. And it's just so how deeply connected it is to this idea of the American dream, which is just something so important to Americans in history, but also Americans now. It's so important to learn about this history and see how people are grappling with it now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Caitlin. This has been very illuminating.
Thanks for listening to the MidStory Hour. We have a full lineup for our next episode, so tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. to hear more about MidStory, our home, and our greater region. If you have a story you'd like to share or would just like to drop us a note, please contact us at contact@midstory.org. We'd love to hear from you. The MidStory Hour is a MidStory podcast produced in collaboration with WGTE. It features original work produced by our dedicated team of reporters, researchers, data analysts, and creators. This episode was hosted, edited, and written by Evan Blanco. Artwork is by Ruth Chang and Joshua Rep. This week's episode featured stories by the Greater MidStory team, including Celia Johnson, Yaffa Siegel, Caitlin Cooper, and Desiree Lua. MidStory is a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to progressing the Midwest narrative through multimedia storytelling, solutions-oriented research, and community programming. Founded in 2018 by four individuals who found their way home from the East Coast to Toledo, Ohio, MidStory re-envisions the Midwest story through a productive, bright, and influential future. Learn more at www.midstory.org.